There are a couple of international meetings starting today, the other ones being opened in China later in the day by President Hu. But once again, Sydney's managed to upstage Beijing. We've got in first. And so I'm delighted to open this meeting and to welcome our first speaker, or perhaps I should say our first competitor, Professor Tim Crane from UCL, who's going to be talking to us on images and intentionality. Tim, or are you going to be talking to us on picturing something and perceiving?
Yes, yeah, something like that.
Can you hear me? Is that clear? Thanks. Thank you very much, Hugh. Thank you for the invitation. So the title of my talk is Picturing and Perceiving. I'd like to just start off by saying something about this picture. This is Constantine Brancusi's picture of Joyce. It was called Symbol of Joyce, which he famously did in Paris in 1929, I think. When Joyce's father in Dublin saw this picture, he said, "The boy seems to have changed a good deal." Now, of course, the sense in which that is a picture of Joyce, if it can be said to be a picture of Joyce, is actually not the sense that interests me. But I will say something which has some relevance to that, to the point of that remark. Towards the end of my talk. The sense, of course, which is relevant to what I'm saying is the sense of picturing where we picture things in order to represent them, where by that I mean to represent how they look. And I'm going to use that word representational or not, as opposed to non-representational painting to mark that distinction. What I'm interested in is the question, an old question, which I think deserves to be revived, which is what, if anything, can be learnt about perception from thinking about picturing? Is there anything about the similarities between pictorial and perceptual forms of representation, whatever those similarities are, which tells us something about the nature of perception? That's my general topic. And I'm going to say that there is, and I want to say that reflection on some aspect of pictorial representation can actually give us a reason for and an understanding of a certain thesis that I want to hold, and that thesis is that perception is not what I'm going to call a propositional attitude. And I think anyone who's familiar with recent philosophy of perception of the last sort of 10 to 20 years or so will be aware that the thesis that perception is a propositional attitude or that it has propositional content is a thesis that's probably a relatively orthodox, widespread view. In fact, it's so widespread that denying it can give rise to incredulous stares, but that's what I want to deny. I say that perception is not a kind of propositional representation, and I think that reflection on comparisons between pictures and perceptions can help support this fact and also help us understand it. So that's my question. Just to forestall any possible misunderstanding here, or at least one possible misunderstanding, I'm not going to be saying or even examining the claim that experiencing or perceiving something is anything like looking at a picture. I don't think that's true. There aren't pictures in the head, there isn't a homunculus that looks at them, and experiencing doesn't even seem like looking at a picture. Damasio talks in one of his books about the question of consciousness being the question of how we get the movie in the brain. But that's not only a bad way of talking, it's a bad way of thinking. There isn't a movie in the brain. Experiencing things is nothing like watching a movie, and for similar reasons there aren't pictures in the brain. Experiencing things is not pictorial. I say perceiving is not pictorial, by which I mean perceiving is not like looking at a picture. It's rather the order of the comparison is rather the other way around. That when an artist intends to paint a representational painting, they're intending to represent how things look. That I take to be part of the definition of a representational painting. So if you're trying to, so when this, the Chardin who painted this painting was trying to represent a way in which those apples look. He's not saying that experiencing those apples is like looking at that picture. So this is my thesis then, that the correct understanding of the phenomenon of pictorial representation can illustrate and support this claim that perception is not a propositional attitude. But before saying why I think that's true, let me first say something about the other word in the title of this meeting, which is intentionality. So I'm going to say something about intentionality, then I will talk a little bit about the idea of accuracy and whether we should think of pictures as true or false. And then I'm going to distinguish between describing the content of a picture and something being the content, and then I'm going to conclude. Basically, I'm going to look at two reasons for thinking that perception is a propositional attitude and dispute them both. And the first reason is that perceiving has what are sometimes called accuracy conditions, and the other is that the content of a perception can be completely described in sentential form. But first of all, let me say something about intentionality, because this notion of the content of perception or the content of experience is a notion that it's not a sort of everyday or ordinary notion. It's a notion that has its home in the theory of intentionality. Let me summarize briefly the way I think of the notion of intentionality, and these pieces of little terminology are described on the handout, but of course I'm willing to say much more about it if anyone's interested. The notion of intentionality I take and describe in the abstract way as directedness upon the world, or directedness upon direction upon an object, as Brentano said. By an object here, I use the term object simply to mean what it is that one's mind is directed on in a when in an intentional state or an intentional act. So that I don't mean anything more than that. I just mean the object of a state of mind is just what the state of mind is directed on. I could use the word intentional object for that, but by object I mean intentional object. So I don't mean necessarily physical object or material object or something like that, although physical objects and material objects can be intentional objects, but they're not all the intentional objects. Now I say that in addition to the notion of an object and the direction of the mind upon the object, we also need the notion of content. The notion of content is I define as the content of a state is the way its object is represented. So for me, the notion of representation and the notion of content go together. So if someone doesn't like talking in terms of the mind as representing things or mental states as representing things, then they're not going to like the word content as I use it. But by the content of a state, I mean the way its object is represented. Now, I agree with Husserl here in his early writings to say that the object, that the content of the state, as I'm using that term, is what's real in the state. The object transcends the state in the sense that it's not a part of the state, and it's something which is not, the state itself does not determine whether it has a real object. Although, of course, all states have intentional objects, and all intentional states have intentional objects in the sense of something that they're directed on. Now, the third notion is what I would call the notion of mode, the intentional mode, which is the mode of directedness upon an object. So if you fear an object rather than admire it, these are different intentional modes, different ways in which your mind is directed on a particular object. Now, so there are three notions there: object, content, and mode. As I'm thinking of intentional states are constituted out of a intentional mode plus intentional content. And then the object is something else or nothing at all. So I think of Othello here, and there's a picture of Paul Robeson and Vivien Leigh in playing Othello in Desdemona. If Othello's desire is to spend time with Desdemona, then spending time with Desdemona, that describes the content of his state of mind. The mode there is the desire, the want. And that's the way I'm thinking of the structure of an intentional state. If I could say Othello loves Desdemona, Desdemona is the object of his love, that state of mind does represent Desdemona in a certain way. If there is such a thing as a state of love, it represents Desdemona in a certain way rather than others. Now, when people talk about content in a lot of recent philosophy of mind and language, content often means propositional content. In fact, I say it normally means propositional content, where a proposition is something that's true or false. So that's how I define what a proposition is. A proposition is the ultimate bearer of truth value. So when you assert a complete sentence, you express a proposition. What you express is true or false. Different sentences can express the same proposition, and the same sentence can express different propositions. So the proposition is what is expressed by a complete sentence. A proposition is what is asserted. And I think it's also right to say that a proposition is what is believed. It's what is believed can be true or false. What is believed, what is judged, and so on. Now, Russell invented the term propositional attitudes for states like belief and hope and judgment, and these are often called attitudes towards propositions. This is a kind of long-winded way of saying that they're attitudes towards the world, that having a belief is an attitude towards the world, which we can redescribe as holding true a proposition or something, or taking something to be the case. What you take to be the case is that a certain proposition is true. So belief, I think, is a propositional attitude. It has a content that it represents its objects in a particular way. The content of the belief that in particular can be true or false. Similarly, I think, there's been a long tradition that even though on the face of it, something like desire, on the way we describe desires, wants and desires and so on, we describe them as directed on things, on particulars or on states of affairs or something. But there are good reasons for thinking that we should think of the underlying structure of desire as towards a state of affairs, which then would be expressed in terms of a proposition. That, so rather long-windedly, then we would say that Othello wants it to be the case that he spends more time with his wife or something. And there are reasons for that, which I don't want to go into here, but there's the reasons are quite good ones for thinking that, that desire is a kind of propositional attitude. So a propositional attitude, then, is an intentional state whose content is true or false. So if there are intentional states whose contents are not assessable as true or false, then not all intentional states are propositional attitudes. And so I think that there are intentional states whose contents are not assessable as true or false. And so I think that not all intentional states are propositional attitudes. So I define the term content to mean the way the object is represented, and that's a bit vague, I can go into a bit more detail, but thinking about an object, say thinking about Hesperus, needn't necessarily be being in some propositional attitude state with a content evaluable true or false. It needn't be a matter of thinking that Hesperus is F, has some property. Thinking about Hesperus is thinking about it in some way or other, so it has, it's thinking about it as Hesperus, for example. You could also think about Hesperus by thinking about it as Venus or as Phosphorus. These are different ways of thinking about the same thing. And so, since the thing there is represented in different ways, these different ways of thinking about have different contents, as I'm using the word content, but the content is not evaluable as true or false. So there are many intentional states like this. On the face of it, desire looks to be such a state. I said that there are reasons for thinking that it isn't underneath, but there are many, like fear, for example, and imagining something. So imagining an object or an event is not imagining something that can be true or false. It's just imagining, it's just representing something in a certain way in the imaginative mode. So that's the sort of broad picture of intentionality that I'm starting with, which I think is neutral between a number of different views. But what it's inconsistent with is the view that intentional states are propositional attitudes. All intentional states are propositional attitudes. That's the view I reject. So given that, what reason is there to think, given that intentionality in general is not all propositional, as I'm going to say, and given that perception is intentional, what reason is there to think that perception has a propositional content? As I say, this is a widespread view. I haven't given citations and chapter and verse for all the people who hold this view, but it's I think it's probably worth saying that it's a sort of orthodox kind of view. I should perhaps say, just to make it clear what I'm attacking, is I think that what I'm attacking is the view that Sellars held and that McDowell has endorsed in his reconstruction of some of Sellars' ideas, that which summed up by saying that experiences contain claims. Something that McDowell thinks, that experiences contain claims about the world. That's what seems to me to be wrong, that experiences don't contain claims. And in that sense, Austin is right, that the senses don't say anything. The senses are dumb. That's a bit of a misleading way of putting it, because I want to say that experience is actually representational, but experience doesn't contain anything like a claim or an assertion or anything analogous to that. However, many people think that experiences have propositional content, and the first reason I'm going to look at for thinking that is, has recently been discussed a lot by Susanna Siegel, Alex Byrne, and other people, and that's the view is that experiences have accuracy conditions, that they can be accurate or inaccurate. And that when you have an experience, there are conditions on its inaccuracy, on its accuracy. And that for something to have accuracy conditions is just a way of its having correctness conditions, and you might as well say, given if you've gone that far, that if something has correctness conditions, then it expresses a proposition, because the proposition says how things are if the state is going to be correct. So you move from thinking that experiences can be accurate or inaccurate to thinking that they have truth or valuable contents. Now, just to make exactly clear what I'm doing here, I've said intentionality isn't all propositional. So we need a reason for thinking that the intentionality of perception is, if we think perception is intentional at all. Here's a reason, but this is a reason I'd like to dispute. It doesn't follow from the fact that a representation has accuracy conditions, that it's accurate or inaccurate, that it has propositional content. And here's where I'd want to bring in pictures. Here's a picture of Frege, a portrait of Frege, which is, you know, a very, very good portrait. Even though it's not especially accurate as a representation of Frege, it's not very accurate. It's taken from a photograph, and a certain amount of kind of accuracy or fidelity to its subject has been lost in this representation. Nonetheless, it's a picture of Frege. So pictures can be accurate or inaccurate. To say a picture has propositional content, then, given what I mean by propositional content, is to say that its content is true or false. On the face of it, there's nothing in that picture that is true or false. I say this picture is pretty good. I mean, it's a very good painting, but it's a pretty good representation of Frege, but it's not especially accurate. There's nothing in the picture which is true or false on the face of it. And this isn't, in terms of how we ordinarily talk about pictures and things, this seems like the way, true to the way we ordinarily talk, that we don't think of pictures as true or false. So accuracy doesn't seem to be the same kind of thing as truth on the face of it, because truth, as we're thinking of it here, is something that is on or off. It's all or nothing, whereas accuracy is not all or nothing. Accuracy is a matter of degree. Now, there are ways of responding to that, which are quite obvious, which I'm not going to go into. That you can think of the accuracy of a representation, of a complex representation, could be broken down in terms of the truth or falsehood of the representations that constitute it. You could respond in that kind of way. So I'm not going to let anything depend on the idea that accuracy is a matter of degree and truth isn't. I rather want to focus on another point about accuracy. I say that on the face of it, pictures aren't true or false. So if you just bear with me, as they say on the telephone in England these days, if you just bear with me for a moment, be patient, even if you find that view completely implausible, and I will say why that's important in a minute. I think it's worth pointing out that a desire to, I've said a desire has propositional content, but it doesn't seem right to say that desires are accurate or inaccurate. In fact, that doesn't really make any sense. Say that desires are inaccurate. That's any more than it makes much sense to say that desires are true or false. I mean, it's a consequence of the way of looking at desire as a propositional attitude that that its content, if it has a propositional content, this artifact of the little theory that I've made up, the content is true or false. But the desire itself isn't true or false, and nor is a desire accurate or inaccurate. A desire is a state that motivates us to pursue some goal or end or some desirable outcome, but it's not evaluated for accuracy or inaccuracy. And yet it's a propositional attitude. So this means we've got this sort of double dissociation of being a propositional attitude from being something that can be accurate or inaccurate. And what this suggests to me is that the notion of accuracy or correctness, of which truth might be thought to be a special special case. The notion of accuracy or correctness goes with the intentional mode rather than with intentional content. But it's certain kinds of intentional modes which are responsible for saying that a state is accurate or inaccurate. So, for example, belief and judgment are accurate or inaccurate, or true or false. Because beliefs and judgments, the function of a belief or a judgment is to attempt to get things right or get the world right. Belief aims at truth in that platitude. Desire doesn't aim at truth. And there are non-propositional states that aim at truth or accuracy. So an example I'm very interested in at the moment is the phenomenon of believing in something. Where believing in something is a matter of having certain a matter of your ontological commitments, what you're committed to the existence of. So if I believe in numbers, or I believe in ghosts or something, these are the things I'm committed to. These are things whose existence I'm committed to. I think there are good reasons for thinking that believing in something is not the same thing as believing that that thing exists, but it's a distinctive attitude which is aiming at correctness or accuracy. That you want, when you believe in ghosts, you think that's part of the correct story of the world, that there are ghosts. But it's not simply believing that something exists. Now, if there is such a state, and here on the handout I just mentioned some recent work by Zoltán Szabó on this on this notion of believing in. And if there is such a state as believing in, then it's an example of something which is accuracy-directed, but not a propositional attitude. So the very fact that we might say that perceptions are accurate or inaccurate, that our senses can deceive us, or that our perceptual machinery can kind of get the world wrong, the very fact that these phenomena occur is not enough on its own to get us to the conclusion that perception is a propositional attitude. However, someone could say, well, okay, it doesn't entail it, and if you think that there is this distinction between accuracy and truth, then fine, it's not supposed to entail the thesis, but maybe this is the best explanation in some way of the thesis that of the fact of perceptual error and accuracy. The best explanation is that that perception is a propositional attitude, even if it's not entailed by it. So in this sense, one might also say, object to what I just said about pictures and say, well, you know, a picture isn't... we say that pictures aren't true or false, but that's just a matter of kind of everyday usage. After all, this is... So this scene here represents the blind Orion being led towards the rising sun. Since there never was such a person as Orion, this never happened, so what this scene represents is false. Now, someone might say, well, the reason that pictures aren't true or false isn't just a matter of niceties of usage, but rather has something to do with the function of truth and falsehood in governing assertion. So when you assert something, you're putting it forward as true. Pictures themselves don't put anything forward as true. Pictures make no assertions, which is true. I think pictures don't make assertions. That's kind of what philosophers used to call a category mistake, what we could just call a mistake. It's pictures don't make assertions. People make assertions. They make assertions by saying things. But when you think of it that way, then it seems that actually if people make assertions, then why can't they use a picture to make an assertion? After all, a sentence doesn't assert anything. It's only the use of a sentence that asserts something. So if that were true, then we could, if we distinguish then between what the sentence says and what its content is, and an assertion of something with that content, then we could do the same for pictures. This line says that wants to defend the idea that pictures could be true or false. I could use this picture to show, I could just say, well, this never happened. Right? Because there was no such person as Orion, so this never happened. Right? So this is, I'm using the picture there to make an assertion. And that would be like using a sentence to make an assertion. So once we've got something which has a representational content, and you can use it to make an assertion, if it's the kind of thing you can use to make an assertion, why not say that it's true or false? And then the distinction I just wanted to make in section 3 of my handout is not correct. Here's another example. So Napoleon crowned himself emperor. He's just putting the crown on. I think he's about to put the crown on his own head at this point. This picture doesn't say that Napoleon crowned himself. Rather, it represents it. And I could use the picture on this view to say that Napoleon crowned himself. I could say, this is what Napoleon did. So, I think it would be kind of boneheaded to deny that someone could do that, and that we do it. You show someone a picture, you say, you don't understand, you know, this is what it was like, and show them a picture of some terrible event or something. So a picture can be used to make an assertion. And so isn't it right to talk of that in terms of the content of the picture being the kind of thing that can be true or false, just like the content of a sentence, asserted or not, is something that's true or false? Well, here, I think it's right to say you can assert something by using a picture, even though the picture asserts nothing in itself. Nonetheless, there is a crucial difference between asserting by using a picture and asserting by using a sentence. And this can be brought out if we consider this example again. I've told you that this is a picture of Napoleon crowning himself. I've used those words to describe the picture. Now, it could be that the picture was much, much more accurate than this, and you could actually recognize Napoleon's face very close up, and you could recognize the Empress Josephine kneeling before him and all the other figures, and you could come to learn that Napoleon crowned himself. But seeing the picture as representing Napoleon crowning himself is not the same as asserting that Napoleon crowned himself. How do I assert that by using the picture? What's the difference between asserting that Napoleon crowned himself and asserting that it never happened? If you said that, if you want to use a picture to say that something didn't happen, then you have to represent that state of affairs too, because you have to say what state of affairs it is that you think didn't happen. So, of course, we know how to do that if we have symbols which are not pictures, or if we have conventions. We might say, like in traffic signs or something, you know, or we could have a convention of drawing a cross through the whole thing as representing that it didn't happen. We could do that. But the point would be that that would be an extra pictorial representation. So just as asserting that this didn't happen would require some representation other than the picture itself, so asserting that it did happen would require such a thing. Merely putting forward the picture as what it represents isn't asserting anything. Just holding up a picture is not asserting something. You have to do something else other than just use the pictorial content. And actually, this, of course, is a very familiar fact about pictures, that what the picture represents is often, I mean, in the case of paintings particularly, I mean, the situation is different for photography, and there are other issues there. But in the case of paintings, what a painting represents will often be a matter of having some extra pictorial content added to the painting. So let me say that that's St. Paul. And it's not important for that to be a picture of St. Paul, that St. Paul actually looked like that. Similarly, three philosophers. You know. Which three? Well, it doesn't matter. Or, again, moving away from representational painting, the symbol of Joyce. In order for that to be the symbol of Joyce, it has to be given the title, Symbol of Joyce. Now, there's a very familiar and commonplace points about pictures, but I think that they're a consequence of a general phenomenon about the representational content of pictures, which is that a picture doesn't assert anything. The picture itself doesn't assert anything, and it can only be used to assert something by using non-pictorial symbols. So that's my reason for thinking that the way in which the notion of accuracy applies to pictures is different from the way that it applies to truths and falsehoods, to sentences and propositions. However, I think that someone could agree with that and say that's an interesting or uninteresting distinction, depending how interested they were in the distinction. Someone could agree with the point and say that there is still fundamentally something going on in picturing and in perceiving, which is something like a propositional form of representation. And this is what I want to consider finally in point number five. Which is this, that when you have a picture, you can always say what it is that the picture represents. You can always say in a sentence what the picture represents. So it seems like you can give a sentence which expresses what the picture represents. And why isn't that giving a sentence which has the same content of the picture? And if it has the same content of the picture and the content of the sentence is propositional, then why isn't the content of the picture propositional? And someone might say, well, for all that stuff about accuracy and truth, I agree with you, there are distinctions that can be made about how the content interacts. And I'm not, by saying that the content interacts with, say, speech acts like assertion, someone could agree with everything I've said up to the end of point four here, but still say, well, isn't there this fundamental sense in which pictorial representation must be propositional because there is always a sentence that can give the content of a picture. I think I want to concede that there will always be a sentence that gives the content of a picture. I don't think anything here should hang on. I mean, there may be some reason that I haven't considered why that isn't true, but I don't think anything should hang on here the inexpressibility of the content of a picture. Of course, it's very hard to describe a picture. No one would go in for that. Giving the 1,000 words that it would take to express what's in a picture, what's represented by a picture. But if we have a flexible enough vocabulary, then we can do it very easily. We could say some complex state of affairs that would be very hard to describe in terms of the actual position of every cigarette on the pavement here. Be rather hard to describe. I mean, it could be done in principle. You could just pixelate the whole thing and say which color is instantiated at which point, and then you can derive the description of the whole thing from that. Or you could just say, this is how things are, or this is how things seem, or this is how things look. And that is a sentence which does give the content of this picture. Of course, you couldn't understand what that sentence was saying unless you saw the picture, but that's a different point. I mean, I'm not talking about what it takes to understand the sentence. I'm talking about whether the sentence can say something and be understood by those who meet the condition for understanding it, which itself can be true or false. Now, I think the picture, so to speak, there, the phenomenon that is being indicated is that there's such a thing as the content of the picture. There's such a thing as what the picture, as it were, says. And similarly, there's such a thing as the content of the experience. And just as a sentence can give the content of a picture, so a sentence could give the content of the experience. And if the content of the sentence is a proposition, then the content of the experience is a proposition. This is, in effect, what John McDowell says, if anyone knows his discussion in Mind and World about the non-conceptual content of experience. This is what he says there when he says that you can always use a demonstrative expression like this and that to express the content of what is experienced. So this is the second challenge to my idea that perception isn't a propositional attitude, by taking the analogy with pictures seriously and saying that a sentence could always give the content of a picture, and so a sentence could always give the content of an experience. Now, I think it's true that a sentence can give the content of the picture, so I have to say something about what it means to give the content of a picture. What I mean by that, and what I mean by the content of a picture. Now, I want to understand give in a very straightforward, literal-minded way. I want to say that the sentence describes the content of a picture. There could be many descriptions of the content of this picture, for example. But the description of the content and the content itself, in the way I'm using the word content, are not the same thing. So the content itself is, by my definition of content, and you're welcome to have another one, but this is my definition because this is my talk, so I can define things how I like. I say the content is the way the objects of the experience are represented. Now, in current philosophy, it's very natural for people to respond like this. Well, the way the experience is represented, that's something like a proposition. The way the objects of the experience are represented, that the chairs are represented as being red. Or as then people will say, well, now you've got to have a theory of propositions. Propositions are either propositions on the model of Russell, where they're made up of objects and properties, or there's something like propositions on the model of Stolnecker and Lewis, where you talk about propositions as sets of possible worlds, and that the proposition is a sentence which expresses this proposition is true just in case our world is a member of the set of all the worlds which are the proposition. And that those are very familiar ways of talking in contemporary philosophy, but I want to make a rather simple point about these ways of talking, which is that they can't be literally correct. And it cannot be that if a proposition is something that's true or false, it cannot be a set of possible worlds. It cannot be that if a proposition is something true or false, it cannot be an ordered pair of an object and a property. That can't be something that is true or false. I think this is a point that's somewhat neglected in recent discussions. But it goes back to a very important debate in the early 20th century analytical philosophy when Russell and Moore were discussing what they called the unity of the proposition. That a proposition cannot simply be a list of things, or to put it in terms of objects, it can't simply be a collection of things. The proposition that the cat is on the mat cannot simply be the cat, the mat, and some relation of being on. And Russell saw this, and he said that the way to resolve this was to add something that connected all these things, called the mode of combination, or the relating relation. He called it different things at different times. But that's no good, because then if you just add another thing to the proposition, that's just another thing that you add to the list. And that doesn't explain how the proposition hangs together. The proposition has to hang together because otherwise it can't say anything. Because you don't say anything, you can't assert anything simply by giving a list of objects. Similarly, you can't assert anything by simply giving a list of possible worlds, if that were even possible to do such a thing. A set of possible worlds is just a set, and it's not the kind of thing that can be asserted or denied. So what the theorists of propositions these days should say is that you use these invented abstract objects, like sets of possible worlds or n-tuples of objects and properties, to model propositions. That makes it look as if there is such a subject matter, the theory of propositions, which we're trying to model by using these abstract objects. I'd rather look at it another way. I'd rather say there are mental states, and mental states and acts and mental processes, and those are the things that you're trying to model. And talking in terms of modeling propositions is just a way of talking about how to model interesting aspects of those states. For example, their inferential relations, or ideal inferential relations, or normative relations between beliefs and judgments, and so on. So this whole talk about propositions, it seems to me, we shouldn't take it all too seriously. We shouldn't think that there is such a thing as which is the right conception of a proposition or something like that. That's not a real subject. That's a made-up subject. Frege was someone who had an account of the unity of the proposition. As you know, you say the cat is on the mat is analyzed as a relational predication where the objects, the cat and the mat, are arguments of this thing that he called a concept, yielding truth or falsehood, depending on whether the cat was in fact on the mat. Now, whether or not you think this is just a way of re-describing something that we already know, or whether you think this is a significant metaphysical advance, at least Frege was someone who was actually addressing the question, which is important, which is that a proposition is something that has to have this unity. It has to be something assertable. So we shouldn't say that there is such a thing as the content of your belief, and where that content is something like the set of possible worlds in which that belief is true, as if we could, that's a real object that we could describe in various ways. What we should say is that the belief represents the world in a certain way, and that belief can be described as true or false. The belief represents the world, and we can express the way it represents the world in different ways. Now, similarly, I think the same is true with experience, and that there, if we're thinking in terms of the fundamental issue is the nature of these mental states rather than the nature of something called the proposition or the nature of content, then what we're trying to do when we describe the content of experience is give a sentence which picks out how that experience represents the world to be. Now, the sentence itself will express a proposition because it's a sentence, because it has the right kind of structure to express a proposition. It involves predication. But if the experience doesn't involve predication, then it can't be the kind of thing that's true or false, because it's only if we get something like a predicational structure that we can have something that's true or false. So experience does not, I say, involve predication. That is a category mistake, to think experience involves predication. Experience involves representation, not all representation is predicating something of something. In order to predicate something of something, you have to have the structure of the kind of thing that is assertable. And what is assertable is a sentence. And that's why the experience cannot be thought of. That's why the content of the sentence which describes the experience shouldn't be thought of as the same as the content of the experience, because the content of the experience isn't something assertable. And that's why I want to say that experiences don't contain claims. Because to contain a claim is to, as it were, make an assertion. That's what a claim is. A claim is a claim about the world. It's an assertion about the world. An assertion is something that can be true or false. That goes together with predicating something of something. Without that predicational structure, you can't have anything that's true or false. And I think we get misled into thinking that you could have something which doesn't have predicational structure, which is true or false, because people talk in this way about sets of possible worlds being propositions. But for the reason I said, sets of possible worlds can't be propositions if a proposition is what is true or false. So that's my objection to the second reason for thinking that experience must be a propositional attitude. Let me briefly then conclude. I mean, what I've tried to do here is rather modest. I've said, at the general picture of intentionality that I've outlined, it doesn't follow that all intentional states are propositional attitudes. So we need a reason for thinking that perception, if we think it is an intentional state, we need a positive reason for thinking that it is a propositional attitude. Now, I want to say that what I've tried to argue in this talk is that the fact that a state is assessable as accurate or inaccurate does not give us a reason for thinking that it has propositional content. And the fact that the content of the experience can be described in a sentence does not itself imply that experience has propositional content. And so I think we're left without a reason for thinking that experience has propositional content, but that's not a bad thing, because I think that actually, unless we were in the grip of this picture about what intentionality must be, then it wouldn't occur to us to think that experience was a propositional attitude. So, thank you. Because it's not something. I mean, I think that is the right question to ask about what I've been saying. Clearly, that's what many people think. But representing the chair as being red is not something assertable. Now, you assert that the chair is red, and you predicate something of the chair. Representing it as being red is the same as representing a red chair. So, you know, you can't represent a chair without it having some colour or combination of colours. When the predication is true, let's suppose then we think the object does have the property. But that's not the relation of predication, that's the relation of instantiation, that the object instantiates the property, doesn't it? A deathly silence. I know you're unconvinced, but I... So the empty place in the middle is what? I don't know this picture.
So they're meant to... normally the story is that they ate bread and wine and magically it was transformed into the flesh and blood of Christ. And so the fact that the place is empty is illustrating the fact that this didn't happen. The purported fact that it didn't happen.
Well, I've just got two things to say about that. I mean, one is that I don't know why the fact that the plate is empty doesn't represent the fact that they've eaten it. But that's a question of the interpretation of the picture and what the artist is trying to do with that picture. But I suppose the simpler point I wanted to make would be, what's the difference between using that picture to represent that it didn't happen and using the picture to represent that it did happen by saying this is a heretical view, right? It didn't happen. That's what the point I wanted to make with the picture of Napoleon, right? I mean, the idea with a proposition is that you've got the same thing that can be asserted or denied. What amounts to asserting or denying the picture, other than saying it didn't happen, right? It's not contained within the picture itself that it didn't happen. It's because that the picture might be representing that it would be a heresy to say that it did happen, that it didn't happen.
And suppose someone, I can mess up a finger on that, suppose someone says, look, that's true of sentences too. The sentence needs an assertion sign or a denial sign.
Of course, that's right. The sentence itself doesn't assert anything. I want to say that. But to assert a sentence, I mean, you don't actually need... what it is to assert a sentence is an interesting question, because... of course, a sign won't do it, so a sign won't turn something into a genuine assertion. But you don't need...
It's an assertion sign which just does that job.
Yeah, but as Davidson says, then you could use it on stage, you know, if there was a sign, and that wouldn't turn what you're saying on stage into a real assertion.
Yeah, but then as Dummett says in reply, you're not doing something less on stage, you're doing something more. You are using the assertion sign, but you're doing it in a context which doesn't work.
But yeah, what I think about that case is that you, in order to assert something, you don't need anything more than the resources of the language. In order to, I mean, whatever those resources are, right? In order to use a picture to assert something, you need more than the resources of pictorial representation. So even if you had a, you could stick an assertion sign at the front of the picture and Ben's picture, you could say this didn't happen or it did happen or something. This is the case, this isn't the case. But those are things that can't be within the picture themselves.
Yes, I mean, I think it's arguable that the same is true in language, that they're not strictly within the sentence.
They're not within the sentence, I agree. No, but there's something, the resources of what it is to represent something linguistically include more than just a sentence. So whatever it is that involves asserting something.
Okay, let's move on. We've got quite a long list. I'm sorry, I don't know your name.
David. That's a simple clarificatory question about your terminology. So I'm not sure I understand what the content of intentional state is. More specifically, I don't understand why it's not either the same as the object or the mode. So take, for example, my belief that there are red chairs here. So it's directed at red chairs. It's directed at here, this place. And I guess it's directed also at the state of affairs, there being red chairs here. So there's a whole lot in the object. There's also the mode, as I've been believing. And I don't really see what else there is. And the way the object is represented, or the objects are represented, is as red. That's part of the object as well. There are several objects, and the big state of affair objects of my states seems to include the way of representing the particular objects I'm representing.
I agree with almost everything you said apart from that last bit, but it doesn't include it. The belief has many objects, as you say. So there isn't such a thing as the object or the one object. There are many intentional objects of the belief. The same object could be represented in different ways. So if we're talking about the colour, you know, the colour could be represented by a, you know, supposing colours are surface properties of physical objects, suppose for the sake of argument, then it can be represented by a scientific description of that colour. But it can also be represented visually as looking a particular way. The same colour can look different ways in different conditions of illumination, for example. So the same chair could be represented in different ways. So when I say, you know, the chair, this chair is red, right? The object is the chair itself, and that can be represented in different ways, which is why you need the notion of the content. So just take a simpler example, so Hesperus and Phosphorus, right?
Yeah, okay.
Two ways of representing the same object.
So these are mode of presentation. So why don't you call them mode of presentation?
I could. I could, but I don't. So I just call them the content, and that's... I mean, the notion of the mode of presentation is associated with Frege's views, and that has certain connotations that I wouldn't want to have. So, maybe it's misleading to use the word mode for the what I'm calling the intentional mode, but that's the attitude or the belief or what Chalmers calls the manner.
This is probably just a huge question again, but the disanalogy between sentences and pictures, and so you could have a sentence, a line was made towards a sun appearing in the world, condition appearing in a work of history.
Yeah.
In both cases, you seem to be doing something else beyond the sentence, beyond the picture, to make the assertion. So I think in the case of the sentence, the resources of the language are sufficient to make this to do the job.
Yeah.
But it just seems we're using the sentences, we're using the pictures. I'm not sure what hangs on it, but I just query the disanalogy.
Right. I think I didn't answer you completely accurately. Whatever it is that you do when whatever is needed to assert a sentence, that's something that you have within the mastery of your language. And that's, if we call that whole thing, whatever it is, the mastery of your language, your linguistic representational capacity or something, then you need some of that in order to use a picture to assert. So whatever conditions are, I mean, even if they're not purely, even if it was a sign in the language, maybe it isn't a sign in the language, maybe it's something else. But that's...
The pre-linguistic people who have artistic capacities, if that's right, presumably could use pictures to show people how to hunt,
That's a substantial empirical hypothesis. I doubt whether it's true, actually. Right? How could you have a picture without knowing what it's a picture of? I have no idea.
Without language,
I don't think there's any evidence that people had. I don't think there's any archaeological evidence that people had pictures before they had languages.
Is it an empirical question?
There's nothing about the nature of picturing which makes it, which makes it dependent on someone having the capacity to use language.
The use of a picture to make an assertion, I think I'm committed to that. If you do use a picture to make an assertion, then that you have to need language. So that's a hypothesis. It would be falsified if we had convincing evidence that people could use pictures who never had a language.
Yes, so I just want to ask for clarification on this. So you're saying that you can't assert some of the pictures without the resource of language. Do you mean that you can't assert using a iconic representation without some form of symbolic representation? Because it seems to me, is that what you're saying? Because I think you could.
I think so, yeah. I think so.
The resources poor representation uses a lot of non-iconic resources. I mean, in certain sort of genres of film, you know when they use black and white, that it means you're looking at something like the past has actually happened. Whereas if they do it in kind of like a blurry sort of, make it all blurry, then you know this is like a dream or a memory, and it's dubious whether it happened. So, you know, that would be using color as a symbolic of the fact that something did or did not happen.
Yeah.
So I just wanted to clarify whether that was...
That's a really interesting point. I don't know, I don't want to... I'm not sure I want to commit myself on any big thesis about iconic and symbolic representations. My immediate reaction to the point about the colour is that, of course, we interpret these films against the background of a lot of shared knowledge. You know that in the past everything used to be in black and white. You know, or you know what I mean. And that's why these things have these connotations for us. And
there's a fair bit of shared knowledge in the linguistic case too.
Sure. I don't want to deny that, you know. I mean, I'm not saying... You know, of course, there are lots of analogies and there are lots of many much more complicated ways of using pictures to get messages across than I've mentioned here. I'm just saying... I just want to make this point about assertion, that you can't... That to assert a picture as saying that something is the case is to use some other form of representation. And maybe it's to rely on... I'm not sure, but to rely on some rather complicated conventions about how we interpret pictures.
It comes back to whether you reduce it to a linguistic propositional attitude, if you like. You say, is there anything extra-pictorial about a picture? Besides, you know, is there a distinction between a language and picture? Does it reduce to a symbolic representation?
And I mean,
I'm interested in it for its implications anyway, because it has actually massive implications in terms of how we teach and think about pictures. There are strong kind of this strong advocacy that pictures are linguistic propositional representations, strictly reduced to propositional representation, and from that we simply read pictures. Now that entails a massively different way of educating pictures to what having a non-propositional kind of content provides for.
Right, I agree.
So yes, I understand why this hangs on your distinction.
I want to reject that reduction. Yeah.
Say again.
I want to reject the reduction.
I'm very much hoping you are. Counting with it.
Patrick.
I want to agree with one of your conclusions that there are no...
You were next. Patrick.
Me?
You're next.
Tim, don't you need the argument in Ford to generalise to perhaps recherche cases at least that we're interested in? What pictures might necessarily be? Someone might think, it sounds like the presupposition of the argument in Flora is the only way you can get truth or falsity conditions of pictures is by thinking of them along the lines of assertions. Lots of pictures aren't assertive, you might think, they're just suppositional. Imagine it's the case. Suppose. There's no commitment to reality being like that. But suppositions are representational. They're true or false, but without commitment. So do you think that the argument then plays out with respect to There's a suppositional marker in language, and this will be an extra pictorial element to what's going on if I'm offering a picture as a supposition, and therefore getting my truth and falsity conditions and suppositions into the story here. So do you think the argument's going to play out the same with respect to suppositions? So we need some kind of suppositional marker, and that would be extra pictorial.
That's interesting. It's an interesting point. I'm inclined to say yes, on the grounds that, you know, you've got the picture and what it represents, and then you can say, like, suppose that this happened or something. Yeah. And often, in the context in which pictures are used, you don't need to even say it. You don't need to even say those words, but you might be telling a story or something once upon a time or something, and then you you're asking people to suppose that things are like this. Is that supposed to be a bad thing for
I'm just intrigued my view? You think I can generalize. I mean, a further generalization is this oddity about, you know, containing claims, because claims are acts.
Yeah, no,
yeah. The act-state distinction is relevant here as well. So you might think, oh, you, suppositions are acts, assertions are acts. What about the correlative states? So you also think, oh, well, I can get truth or falsity back in the picture, not by some act of supposition, corresponding state, which may go along with an act. Like a belief drops out of an assertion, you might think it's a hypothetical analog. There's a state of hypothesizing which drops out of the act of supposing. Mm-hmm. But then you could need markers, you have to generalize the argument again, I think, to that level of extra markers indicating states. Do you think? You can only get truth and falsity into the picture by going the assertion way and generalizing up. You have to consider suppositions as well. Then some more generalization you need. Forget about acts.
You can only get truth and falsity in by getting. I think my claim was that you can only get truth and falsity in by getting the kind of thing that can be asserted. And the kind of thing that can be asserted is also the kind of thing that can be supposed.
Right.
I think assertion is basic, because assertion is expression of belief. And belief is where you get the idea of, I think this whole talk about propositions comes from thinking of belief as primary, I think. It's what you believe. A proposition is the kind of thing you believe, and then it can be the kind of thing, then extending from that, it's the kind of thing you can suppose to be true, or you can imagine that it's true. So I do think assertion is fundamental, but the point I wanted to make, I think, was just that you actually can only have truth and falsehood when you can have the kind of thing that can be asserted. That's
Andrew.
I wanted to agree with the part of your conclusion that you don't have experience as a predication.
Yeah.
But what does worry me is the use of the word picture. Because in English we could say, picture this, like the story if you have an image of it. And what concerns me is the reduction of works of art or painting to descriptions of content, and how much of your argument, the conclusion of which I agree with, depends upon that analogy. And if one thinks, and you just want to plug examples, I think you'd be one example, Michelangelo's Last Judgment. Sistine Chapel, the description of that over the years is the history of the complex relationship that the Catholic Church has to the human body and humanity of Christ. There is no description of it. That is, you would ever reduce that image to its being its description. And I think one could then make a much larger claim that what is characteristic of paintings as philosophical objects is not that they picture X, but there is no X that is can be commensurate with or identifiable with the so-called picture. And if that's the case, one needs not to argue for your conclusions, because I would argue your conclusion was not straightforward Kantian lines what it's worth, namely that experiences are accountable for in terms of their conditions of possibility, which then allows me to agree with you, but maybe not the reasons that you want. But I would really want to say that the analogy for me doesn't work, because there's a different philosophical story that one would need to tell about paintings, in which they're not reducible to a picture in the sense of picture this, and then you get a commensurability between image and content.
Right. Yes, thanks. I think I want to agree with a lot of what you say. I mean, it wasn't part of what I meant to say that the meaning of a work of art or a painting or a real painting could be reduced or even expressed in terms of a description of everything that is represented in it. I think that would be a complete mistake. So I didn't want to... what I did assume, which is maybe, I'm not sure whether you're disagreeing with this or not, is that there is such a thing as, you know, there is such a thing as depicting something by making a certain kind of artifact where that thing represents something in the world that may or may not exist. Now that's not, that very minimal claim about there being such a thing as that kind of depicting, which is kind of, I would say, the idiom of saying picture this is derivative of that kind of depiction rather than the other way around. That says nothing about the meaning of real pictures and what the meaning that real pictures have in a realistic context. I was just trying to isolate a certain form of representation. So I think I want to agree with most of what you say there.
Okay, I'm next on the list of that thing. I don't feel that I have a strong commitment on one side or the other, but it seems to me, this debate, but it seems to me that the Salazian or the Medallion is going to say to you at this point, because a crucial difference between perceptions and pictures concerning their possible psychological role, which provides a reason for thinking of accuracy and inaccuracy in the case of perceptions as truth or false, to be like, in a way in which it's not for pictures. And that's to do with the fact that perceptions seem to operate as the kind of, in some contexts, they can operate as something like the starting point for an inference. So for almost any perception at all, you can imagine someone being in a condition such that if they have that perception, they'll then come to believe something. And therefore, if they later have reasons for giving up that belief, for coming to think that the perception was not merely inaccurate, but inaccurate in a particular way that we feel this impulse to describe as being false. And given what you want to say about how notions of truth and falsity attach in virtue of cognitive role and so on, that seems to be an objection to which your view is kind of sensitive in a way in which some other people, other kinds of critics wouldn't.
You're right. I mean, I do, I open myself up to that charge. So if you think how John McDowell gets himself into saying that perception is a propositional attitude, he doesn't use those words, but you know, when he says that what you can see that something is the case, and this is also something you can judge, and he wants that view because he thinks only if you have that view can you explain how experience can have rational input into the belief formation process. So I just reject that assumption. I think that experience has input into rational belief formation, and that's a fact about the cognitive role of experience. But it isn't a step in an inference. It's, as it were, it may be the data on which you form some belief, or the reason. The fact that you've seen something.
Call it what you like. Call it the data on the basis of which you form a belief. It still seems to be sensitive in a way in which sort of the first premise in a modus ponens argument is to rejection on the grounds that you then come to change your mind about the belief formed on the basis of that data. So however you characterize initially, it still seems to have, I mean, it seems to be a consequence of it, the fact that it plays that role. That accuracy and inaccuracy for perceptions are kind of much closer to being tied to truth and falsity than is the case for pictures. Precisely in virtue of this psychological role.
And one aspect of the psychological role that I didn't mention, I think, came out when I was talking about desires not being accurate or inaccurate, but belief and other non-propositional attitudes can be accurate or inaccurate or correct or incorrect, because, as it were, they aim at truth. And you might want to say perception similarly has that kind of direction of fit, as I'll say. So therefore, as you're saying, then if you find out something went wrong, you might be inclined to blame the experience and say that it's wrong, so to speak. But I think you can say all that on my view. Because you say the experience misleads you, and as you said, and for that reason you reject the belief that you came to, you reject the belief as false because your experience misled you. You don't need to say the experience.
You come to say the experience misled you because you come to reject the belief as false. So it's kind of modus tollens where you end up as thinking that the perception must have misled you.
Yeah, I can't really. It's a very that's a very difficult question, and I can't possibly be expected to answer it now. But yeah.
Three people. I think you were next.
Well, I was just thinking that if you imagine, say, a calligraphic artwork of the word, for example, where does that land you with the kind of inference that you draw?
Calligraphic artwork of what? Sorry,
calligraphy.
Yeah.
Right. And it's just a hypothetical kind of example I came up with, but a calligraphy of the word, right? How that relates to the linguistic kind of content and what that represents necessarily. I'm not, because it draws in this kind of realism about the language that you speak. It does represent something, but it's not necessarily intentional that it does. Nevertheless, it does, and so on.
You've written the word in a sort of
calligraphy,
in a calligraphically nice sort of way, yeah.
An illuminated manuscript.
Yeah. I think there are, when I said that representation could be linguistic or pictorial, I didn't mean to exclude the idea that it could be both, so yeah, the first letter of an illuminated manuscript might have lots of little drawings of animals or devils or something in it. I didn't want to rule that out, so I didn't mean to say it was an exclusive division between two things.
Yeah, I think it's interesting because it kind of bridges that gap between. Because if you take sort of Māori moko, for example, so the facial tattoos in New Zealand that are traditional to Māori belief, they have a kind of religious value. But whether or not moko is intentionally representational, I mean, whether the tattoos themselves are intentionally representational, is kind of signifies that bridge between our understanding of our intentions and what we do or don't associate with our interpretations of the representations. And then I think, and I'm inclined to agree with yourself, but it does become interesting at that point when we consider whether or not there are also claims and propositions involved in that sort of that bridging or that gap between the intentions of representations.
Right. I think I want to agree with what you said. I mean, there are so many complex forms of representation that I haven't touched on. And as I said to Andrew Benjamin, I didn't mean to imply that all of these things could be reduced to one kind or that there was only one kind of thing that could be called pictorial representations. Thanks.
Yeah, I think it's interesting with the linguistic sort of, because you could think about language in terms of an aesthetic similar to how you can think about paintings and so on. But there is a difference between the two. But the difference, I think, is substantiated in sort of cultural norms and things.
Sure.
Okay, now the next person was just in the row behind in the middle. Yep.
Just a question again about assertion with pictures and assertion with sentences. I'm interested in what is included in language in your account, because it seems to me that what you're saying is when you want to make an assertion using a proposition, you don't need anything extra linguistic, but when you want to make an assertion using a picture, you need something extra pictorial.
That's what I want to say, yeah.
Linguistic.
Yeah.
that your notion of language needs to include quite a lot of contextual pragmatic factors. Because of course you can, you know, say something in a sarcastic tone and that takes away the assertion sign, or write something down which you don't agree with, and that again is the case. And at the same time you can have contextual factors that make a picture an assertion. And I'm thinking about using pictures as historical documents, for instance. Just the fact that you're using them in that way commits yourself to something about the content of the picture being true or being accurate in some way. So the question is just a clarification, how much goes into language? Because it seems to me that it needs to be more than just a symbolic sign. It needs to include contextual.
Oh, I completely agree with that. Yeah, I didn't mean to deny that. But when you say using a picture as a historical document, I'd like to know what that is, because all I need for my distinction, I think, is that using a picture as a historical document would have to involve some linguistic information, use of linguistic information or acts.
Suppose someone keeps a diary and just draws little pictures of the scene, the daily scenes at the bottom of the page.
Yeah.
Don't you think that's enough for us looking at it to think, oh, this is what this person saw?
That's an interpretation of their pictures. You've told me it's a diary, so I now know how to interpret it. But if I just found this object...
Well, you find it, and it's got sentences in it, and it's got pictures. The interpretation seems to be the same for both of them, doesn't it?
All I'm saying is just there's this there's this asymmetry, by which I mean a difference. People use the word asymmetry to mean difference these days. So there's a difference between these cases, and which is that you could write the diary just in words. And you'd need to interpret the words. And of course, you are absolutely right that, you know, interpretation isn't just a matter of, so to speak, just reading off what the literal words are saying. But you couldn't write a diary just in pictures.
You couldn't write it in pictures.
it wouldn't be a diary.
one more question at the back. I forgot who. No, it wasn't you. There was somebody. Yes.
Yeah, so it's like to say I really enjoyed the talk.
Thanks, Lassen. Stop that.
yeah, that's
a great question.
This is also on the topic of the sort of assertiveness of pictorial representations. I just wanted to put forward another example and see what you had to say about it. And maybe this might constitute a sort of thin edge of the wedge in showing how could be assertive. So I guess there's this painting you're probably familiar with by Magritte. I think it might be called The Human Condition. And there's a picture of a doorway looking toward the sea. And there's a painting that's of the sea and the coastline. And it's sort of sitting half, so such that like half of it is in front of the doorway, the other half sort of in front of the wall. Sort of suggests that it's a painting of the way that the sea would continue were the wall not there, were the painting. Right. Do you know the painting?
I know the painting, yeah.
So my question is, it's you know, if you imagine that this painting is just hanging on the wall, or you know, you're in a room where there's, you know, where there's a very long canvas that continues around the wall, and you're starting from the door, I think your default assumption would be sort of, as soon as you saw that painting, you would think it's asserting something, or you'd wonder whether that's how things actually were. You know, it's just the case that you just encounter something like that. Now, that has something to do with the context in which the painting occurs, but it doesn't seem that it's closely tied to anybody's intention to assert something. Like, as in the case when someone holds up that you used it.
Do you mean, I'm not quite sure I understand how you're using this, do you mean that you might be deceived in thinking that the continuation of the landscape outside was what the picture was representing?
I guess what I mean is it's the painting in that context seems to be asserting something. It seems to be asserting that that's the way things are behind the wall.
Yeah. I think that, I don't think that's anything like an assertion. I think that's more like something we might read off it just because of the way it looks. Right.
Okay, I'm afraid we're over time, so I apologise to the president didn't get to ask his question, but I'd like to ask you to join me in thanking Tim for a very good question.